This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Thomas Jefferson. In times past, Americans of a certain age, especially white Americans, were schooled in the legend of that founding father without many difficult questions being raised. This certainly was true for Lucia Stanton. She got her first brief job at Monticello in the late 1960s. Back then, it never occurred to her to wonder about the people who'd kept Jefferson's home running, his slaves. When Stanton returned to Monticello as a researcher a few years later, the lives of the human beings Jefferson had owned still didn't get much of her attention. But slowly, that began to change. By the early 1990s, Stanton and a colleague would embark on an ambitious 20-year project tracking down descendants of Jefferson's slaves, collecting family stories for a previously unplumbed side of American history. Lucia Stanton's new book is titled Those Who Labor for My Happiness, and it will be our focus right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Got thoughts about Thomas Jefferson? Questions about Jefferson and slavery? Then I hope you will join today's conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. Our guest was a longtime researcher at the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello. Today she serves as its senior historian emerita. And fellow scholars across the country credit her with helping us rethink the complexities of Jefferson's life as a slave owner. Her newest book is titled Those Who Labor for My Happiness, Slavery at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Lucia Stanton, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Being over in the valley again is great.
Well, this book and the collection of essays in it is so rich in detail. I'm afraid that if we're lucky, we will only scratch the surface of what's here in the hour ahead. But I need to get, if I could, a non-book related question out of the way first. Legally, your name is Lucia, L-U-C-I-A. But most everybody who knows you calls you by a different name. Could you tell us about that, please?
They call me Cinder, and do you know how many times I've been asked this question in my life?
4,302.
Exactly right. And I should have made up a really good story about how this came about.
We make one up right now.
No, I'm going to tell the truth. That's what history is about. Accuracy, historical truth. My parents had a disagreement about what to name me. My dad wanted to call me Lucia, and my mom preferred Lucinda, and he won. He got me to the baptismal font first, so I became Lucia, but my mom called me Cinda, which in the Midwest, which is where they were, turned into Cinder, and since infancy, I've been called Cinder. I sign my checks Lucia, I write my books as Lucia, but everywhere
everybody knows you as Cinder.
Cinder, yeah. And I tried to shake it off many times in my life, but it's stuck.
I'm just afraid that if I refer to you as anything other than Cinder, then people who are listening who know you won't know that we're talking to you.
They won't know?
Well,
I think
that
people who know me know.
Okay. Do you have a preference?
Well, call me Cinder, please.
All right. Cinder Stanton, your start at Monticello, which was the first time a year in 1968, and then you come back about 7 years later and start what would begin a long career in different aspects of research at Monticello. But you started with something called the memorandum books.
That's right. Jefferson called them the memorandum books, and it was his 60-year record without a break of every penny he ever spent as he crisscrossed the United States and Europe spending money and Spanish bits, French francs, American dimes, the whole works.
Actually, one of the reasons that you were asked to work on this project is because the man who was starting the project, to whom you were an assistant in your first year at Monticello, did not speak French, or at least didn't speak it nearly as well as you did.
I was slightly better than he was at understanding French, so I took away the French years when I left Monticello that time. And the man you're talking about is my first boss at Monticello, James A. Baer Jr., Jim Baer, who has been a model to me of humane and careful scholarship. So he gave me the 5 years Jefferson spent in France to begin annotating those years.
So we can remark at some point later, perhaps, on the number of accidents that ended up with you becoming the person that you've become and the historian that you've become. But the memorandum books are all important. And at first, thinking of accounting books as a key part of history and tracking somebody's life and then leading to new realizations about slavery might not go together in most people's minds. But there was just so much rich detail in these books.
Wonderful detail, some of us think. Others would be bored stiff by trying to read through the memorandum books. But he spent money on waffle irons, fiddle strings, horses, human beings. It covers the gamut. And so when we had to annotate all of these things, identify the people, places, and so forth, you really cover the whole story of life and in that period, in the Jeffersonian period. So editing the memorandum books was served as my graduate school, really. And hundreds of footnotes that I wrote are the closest thing to a dissertation I'll ever complete.
Well, you did study American history at Radcliffe in the 1960s.
Right.
And you ended up coming to Charlottesville because you were married at the time and your husband was doing graduate work at the University of Virginia.
Right.
And sort of by accident, you got this first job that lasted for the year that you were in Charlottesville at Monticello.
Mm-hmm.
And then because you had more fluency in French than your boss, you take some research with you when you and your husband leave Charlottesville to trek around the country on his academic career. Then eventually you come back to Charlottesville on your own, and it's natural when you're back there, was it like 1975?
75.
To go back to Monticello to start working there full time again.
Well, I had to come back to finish the footnotes that I hadn't finished, and then that evolved into having a regular job as a research assistant at Monticello.
But through all that early experience, studying history, where you focused on American history, your first experience working at Monticello, then in the mid to late 70s, working there full time, making it a career. How important was slavery in any of this?
Slavery was just one element of the whole experience at Monticello, the whole Jeffersonian world there, and not a particularly important one to me. My interests ranged from agriculture and natural history to music and art. And the few times I got a chance to spend time exploring those areas, I didn't pay attention to slavery in that period.
Does that strike you as remarkable now?
Remarkable. Interesting word. Maybe so. Certainly, I'm trying to think back to my history classes at Harvard, and there was very little about slavery there either. Somehow, it was under the radar in some way. And that it shouldn't have been, because Jim Baer actually is one of the first scholars to write about enslaved people at Monticello. He wrote about the Hemings family long before many people took an interest in this topic. And there I was working with him. But my interests were elsewhere.
And in what would become more than 35 years working at Monticello?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, not only do you do some remarkable work that gets other historians thinking about slavery in different ways, and I know that you're modest, and I can tell by the look that you're giving me, Cinder, that you're. But I've seen what other historians, major people in the field, including Peter Onuf at the University of Virginia, how much they credit you with helping sort of change the direction of thinking about Thomas Jefferson and slavery. it seems to me that at some point you must have started thinking differently about Thomas Jefferson and slavery.
It's kind of shocking to me when I look back and see how slow I was to realize many things about Jefferson and slavery. Sentences that he wrote that I read over and over for years without really thinking about them or understanding about them. For instance, when he, you know, I worked on the French years. He was riding through eastern France and he saw women working in the fields doing hard labor, and he was shocked at this and thought it was a barbaric perversion of the natural destination of the sexes. And it wasn't until I was beginning to do some research on the enslaved community and Jefferson and slavery that I realized, oh my goodness, he had no problem with watching women drive plows and wield hoes on his own plantation.
As long as they were black.
Right. And so there were moments like that through the years when something made me take notice. And it was a gradual evolution.
Tell us about the early history of Thomas Jefferson becoming a slave owner. Those people who are at least aficionados of American history in that era probably have heard stories about Jefferson once speaking out against slavery, well, more than once in his early years.
Well, as David Bryan Davis, the leading historian of world slavery, said, he was one of the first statesmen to really speak out against slavery. And then he went pretty silent in the 1780s. And people have written whole books trying to explain this. And I've spent many a night trying to figure out what really was going on. And I think it's a combination of reasons. But certainly he was a leader in articulating an anti-slavery position in the early years of the country.
In his early life, he became a slaveholder when? When he turned 21?
Well, he was given a slave of his own, basically a servant, by his father in his will. But his real slaveholding began at the age of 21, when he reached his majority, and he inherited a number of slaves from his father's estate at that point.
And at some point, I think it may have been early in his 20s, he, according to your records, owned about 50-plus slaves. And then he was married, and then a year or so after he was married, his father-in-law died. And it seems like lots of changes took place, including how much more land he suddenly was operating and how many more human beings he owned. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and you've got the chronology down pat there.
I read your book, Cinder Stanton.
Right.
Those Who Labor for My Happiness, Slavery at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello.
Yes, he inherited 135 slaves, men, women, and children, from his father-in-law's estate and 10,000 acres of land. As he said, he doubled the ease of his circumstances, but he also inherited an enormous debt, John Wales's debt to British merchants. But that did catapult him into being one of the largest slaveholders in the county, Albemarle County, and in this colony and state as well.
Is it possible that something as simple as economic self-interest took over? That before he was much of a slaveholder, it was easy for him to rail against slavery, and then suddenly he owned a lot of land, needed a lot of slaves, had a lot of slaves that he inherited, and he went silent about the evils of slavery?
That's not my way of viewing things.
Well, good. Then we ask you what your way of viewing things is when we get back from the break, and we'll also ask our audience to participate as well. If you listening have any thoughts about anything to do with Thomas Jefferson, Monticello, slavery, or anything else about that era of American history. We continue in a bit more than 1 minute. Historian Lucia Cinder Stanton is our guest. Her newest book is titled Those Who Labor for My Happiness, Slavery at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and our guest worked at Monticello for more than 35 years, so she probably has spent more time there than most anyone listening. But I am curious if you who are listening right now have ever visited that famous Jefferson plantation. If so, what do you remember most about what you experienced there? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. After all this time that you have spent studying Jefferson and eventually coming to view slavery as a major part of the Jefferson story, what do you understand about Jefferson and slavery that maybe most of the rest of us don't, Cinder Stanton?
I think one of the things that I certainly feel from having looked at all of this daily for many years is that slavery was not simple and Jefferson was not simple. There are so many reasons for every decision and choice he made in connection with being a slaveholder. And some of them were financial, what you mentioned earlier, but some of it had to do with Jefferson being every inch a Virginian, being so wedded to the law and custom of his state and region. And this included an really indelible racism. And I think that feeling is at the root of why he did not do more, why he didn't free his own slaves, why he did not do more in later years to end the institution of slavery.
Eric in Harrisonburg, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for Cinder Stanton, please.
Yes, I'd like to ask Cinder about, recently I was up at Monticello visiting, and in the underground slave quarters area, there was a display that had the story of a slave, who a young man who Jefferson sent to France to study French cooking, and the young man killed himself while he was in France. And I read this story and just thought of all the sort of, you know, novelistic possibilities, like maybe this young man was somehow, you know, maybe he was like Jefferson's son by a slave or something, and you know, he seemed to have a particular fondness for this slave. Do you know anything about that story?
That would be the story of James Hemings. He was the brother of the best-known Hemings, Sally Hemings, and Jefferson actually took James Hemings with him to Paris when he went to be our representative over there and had him trained in French cookery. And
uh-huh.
And James Hemings actually acted as his chef in his grand residence on the Champs-Élysées in Paris, and then came back with Jefferson to this country in 1789. And continued to work as his chef in Philadelphia and at Monticello. And he didn't kill himself in France. He killed himself when he was living as a free man in Baltimore in 1801. Jefferson by then had freed him very reluctantly, as was usually the case with Jefferson. And James Hemings had asked for his freedom in the 1790s, and Jefferson made an arrangement with him saying that Hemings would first have to teach someone else at Monticello how to prepare French cuisine, and then he could be free. And this did happen in 1796. So James Hemings took his own life 5 years after becoming a free man.
Wow.
Eric, terrific question. Thank you so much for joining us on the Virginia Insight. 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. If you want to join the conversation with Cinder Stanton, author of the new book, Those Who Labor for My Happiness, slavery at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. And Cinder, I imagine that we're going to come back to the Hemings a number of times, and of course, what some still consider a controversy, others consider a settled matter about Jefferson's relationship with Sally Hemings. But let's do one small bit of the foundation of this story, if we could. We said a little earlier that Jefferson's increase of land and increase of number of human beings that he owned jumped significantly when he got this inheritance after his father-in-law died. And do I remember correctly that his father-in-law, his wife's husband, was John Wales?
His wife's father, that's right.
His wife's father, I'm sorry. Yes,
John Wales.
And there seems to be a fair amount of agreement in history that that Sally Hemings and her siblings had a white father, and that that white father was, in fact, John Wales.
Most historians agree that John Wales was the father of six children of Elizabeth Hemings, known as Betty Hemings, and Madison Hemings, Sally Hemings' son, was the main source for that. He talked about his mother and her siblings.
So Sally Hemings and her siblings, her,
including the James Hemings that Eric asked about,
they all came to Jefferson's ownership by virtue of this inheritance when his father-in-law died, and when, in fact, most historians believe this man, who was the white father of these slaves, of the Hemings slaves, even before we get to the relationship between Jefferson and one of those slaves.
Right. There's far less evidence about John Wales as the father of six of Betty Hemings' children, but it's been accepted by almost everyone. And
they were light-skinned.
They were light-skinned, definitely. And they had other siblings who may have been as light as they. I mean, they're still, we know that Sally Hemings' oldest sister or half-sister, Mary Hemings, was also very light-skinned, but we don't know who her father was.
Next is Swope Carroll. Thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Cinder Stanton, please.
Yes. My sister from England was recently visiting, Monticello and had an absolutely terrific time. And she turned to me at the end, and I wished that Cinder had been there with us. And she just said, "I do not get it. I don't understand how a man as brilliant as Thomas Jefferson, as apparently caring about people, all the just his legislations and all his brilliant inventions, how could such a man own slaves? I don't get it." And I guess my question for Cinder is, if I send my sister in England your book, will she understand?
I wish that would be the case. Possibly. It's so complicated, and it's so puzzling to many of us how Jefferson could say all men are created equal and be a lifelong slave owner, how he often said he had scruples against selling slaves, but he sold more than 100 men, women, and children in his lifetime. And he had he made derogatory remarks about people of African descent in you know, very loudly in the notes on the state of Virginia, and also called free blacks pests of society. Yet he relied on so many people of color to take care of his house, his children, his crops.
Yes.
How do we understand that? And, you know, as some authors have said, he was a master of denial and compartmentalization. So that's part of it. He also was a man of the Enlightenment, and he really subscribed to the view, which he considered a law of nature, that our interests, our self-interest, coincides with our moral duties. And In this way, he could talk about making his estate more profitable, but also trying to make it more humane at the same time. So he was, I mean, it seems an impossible conflict to me, but he really did believe that. And he was such an optimistic and curious person in as the American epitome of the Enlightenment, that he could really believe that slavery would end soon. But meanwhile, it was the law of the land, and he was not going to rock the boat. And he kept expecting that Virginia would have a constitutional convention in which emancipation could be raised as a policy. So he was rationalizing away all kinds of things and imagining that things would keep getting better.
So, Cinder, to Carol's question about if she was to send a copy of your book to her sister in England, would her sister be able to answer this question, why was this the way it was? It sounds like what you're saying is no, that probably not, but she might have a much deeper appreciation of the paradoxes and the ironies involved.
Right. I think, I mean, after having written the whole contents of this book, I can't answer her question well. But I think that she will understand what slavery was like in Jefferson's time and at his plantation and all the complexities of the daily life, the management. I mean, a lot of the early part of the book is about Jefferson as a manager of enslaved people. How did he control their work routines, their marriages, but also how did he try to introduce humanitarian reform into their management, even though at the same time being unable to recognize the full humanity of his enslaved people. So I think it will help people see all sides of slavery as it existed at Monticello.
Well, that's terrific. Her birthday is coming up very soon, and believe me, she's going to get a copy of it, but I'm going to read it first.
Carol, thank you so much for calling us. The book is titled Those Who Labor for My Happiness, Slavery at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Its author, Lusa Cinder Stanton, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Cinder, tell us about a slave named Jupiter.
Jupiter was born in the same year as Thomas Jefferson on the same plantation, Shadwell. And we can assume that they played together as young boys. Jupiter became Jefferson's manservant later and accompanied him as he would go back and forth to Williamsburg and Richmond. And he, at one point, I believe that he complained about having to rattle all over Virginia back and forth and asked to remain at Monticello because by then he was married. Jupiter is clearly a strong personality. It comes out in the accounts of Jefferson's family members. At one point, Jefferson became very angry because Jupiter would not send a horse from the stables for a boy to ride into town to get the mail. And this happened a couple of times, and finally he called Jupiter into his presence, and he really gave him a talking to. The family said, you know, one of the only two times they've seen Jefferson so angry. And Jupiter said, well, I couldn't let just a boy ride around on your horses. You know, they're too good for that, basically. He was standing up for the integrity of his job as being in charge of Jefferson's blooded horses in the stable.
And Jefferson's horses were considered extremely valuable, and Jefferson considered them extremely valuable and was very meticulous about their care and demanding that they be cared for in very particular ways. So as you tell the story in your book, Jupiter may have been the only slave to have ever come close to telling his boss off.
He tried. And he's definitely one of the admirable characters, and there are many of them.
And there seemed to be fairly good indication that to the degree that it was possible between a white owner and a black slave, that these two people were friends. And certainly Jefferson seems to have been devastated when Jupiter fell ill and eventually died.
I think he was very much affected. But then you see in what he writes this terrible combination. A slave was both a human being and a piece of property. And Jefferson responds to Jupiter's death in a dual way. He says, "I'm sorry for the death of Jupiter, but it leaves a gap in my household administration, and I don't know how to fill it." So he was thinking of Jupiter's role at the same time that he was thinking about Jupiter's unfortunate death. And this is what slavery does to people.
To you who are listening, what did you learn about Thomas Jefferson in school? And how does that compare with how you see him today? Your voice is welcome in this conversation. 888-WMRA Talk translates in all numbers to 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer, you can post a question or comment to us on our Facebook page. On Facebook, we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. How do we know what we know about Jefferson and his slaves?
Ah, you've raised the issue of the Jefferson Archive. More than 60,000 documents have survived, which is a real treasure house for those of us who have worked at Monticello all these years. But is it balanced when it comes to thinking about people who lived in slavery at Monticello? And that was the big challenge for us back in 1992-93, when it was the commemoration of Jefferson's 250th birthday. Dan Jordan, the director, encouraged us to come up with new programs. We came up with four major programs to help fill the gap in the interpretation of slavery, one of them being an outdoor tour called the Plantation Community Tour, focusing on the African-American community. So how to learn about their lives, to talk about their lives from their perspective, when everything in Jefferson's archive focused on labor rather than the human element of their lives. So that became the focus of my research, to try to find the perspective of the enslaved people, and led to another major program.
You and a colleague embarked on something called the Getting Word Oral History Project.
That's right.
And this went on for almost 20 years. Started in 1992.
Right.
What was it?
Well, Getting Word, and that was the name given to it by my colleague in the project, Diane Swan Wright, who did have experience with oral history. I had none. And we wanted to go out to listen for the voices of Monticello's enslaved people through the memories of their descendants. So we sought out descendants.
And you found descendants of Jefferson's slaves all around the world. Talked to many of them, especially those in this country. So we'll hear some of what you found, and I think maybe how that changed your life, Cinder Stanton, when we continue here on Virginia Insight. Sabrina is next on the phone line, but we still have a couple of phone lines open if you want to join this conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. Over a more than 35-year career with the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello, Cinder Stanton has served as Assistant Director of Research, Associate Director of Research, Director of Research, and then the Shannon Senior Historian. Although she officially retired several months ago, she still carries the Senior Historian title in emerita fashion. Her latest book, Those Who Labor for My Happiness, is our focus today. And if you want to talk to Cinder, we do have a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Sabrina, thanks for using that number and calling in your question or comment, please.
Hi. I just wanted to share a little bit about kind of my knowledge and experience with Thomas Jefferson. I lived mostly in Washington State growing up, and I learned about presidents and history, and then I moved to the Charlottesville-Lynchburg area when I came to college. My sister ended up attending UVA and came home with all these rich stories about Thomas Jefferson. They're obviously very fond of him there at UVA. And I had this idea of him as this noble man with this great character. And then I began to kind of learn some of these, almost I feel like they were rumors about these inconsistencies in his perspective and how he treated the slaves that he had at Monticello. And I just have had kind of a hard time with trying to understand how to view him with this paradox is what I feel like it is. And I just was hoping that maybe Cinder could share how that process was for her and maybe give a little bit of advice about how to reconcile these two realities.
Reconciliation? Is it possible? Thanks, Sabrina. And I've been giving talks on Jefferson and slavery for 20 years or so. And I've had people come up to me afterwards and said, I thought you really liked Jefferson. And then I suddenly thought you hated Jefferson. And then I thought you liked him and really admired him. In other words, in talking about Jefferson in general and Jefferson and slavery, you go from the good to the bad and back to the good and back to the bad. And that's just the way it is. It's all one package. We have to bring out all sides of the issue. And I think he convinced himself in some ways that his slaves were better off under his protection and, of course, control, and that he was trying to make the conditions of their lives better. Now, his financial position made this somewhat impossible, but I think he did convince himself that this was a better situation for them. And of course, as you've learned, I'm sure, he was totally paternalistic in his thinking, believing that the giving freedom to those whose habits were formed in slavery was like abandoning children. He just diminished their capabilities to protect himself from this terrible thing of owning a human being. So it goes back and forth and up and down, and we have to recognize at the same time that Jefferson's first priority was the nation, the Union, and most of his energy was devoted toward preserving and maintaining that. It was much more fragile during his life than we realize. And he was constantly worried that the country would slip back into monarchism. So we have to see him whole, and we don't always like what we see.
Sabrina, did you say that your sister went to the University of Virginia, but not you?
Yes, that's correct.
Of course, Thomas Jefferson's University is what UVA is sometimes referred to as. What did your sister come to believe about Thomas Jefferson spending time at UVA?
I really don't think that she, I mean, I kind of talked to her about it once and just brought up some of the things that I had heard. A friend gave me a book, American Sphinx is what I think it was called, and I kind of brought up the subject, and she really just kind of dismissed it. I think that she preferred to view him as TJ, which is what I guess they call him there.
We do too.
And didn't really feel the need to try to grapple with those two things. She appreciated what he had done for UVA and was happy to kind of keep him in that perspective.
The dark side of Thomas Jefferson, it seems to me, Cinder Stanton, is something that not only UVA has been accused of ignoring or pretending doesn't exist, but Virginia as a whole. This discussion of the ironies of this man who was once against slavery, the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence, the man who then inherited slaves and inherited great debt and kept those slaves and used them to try to work his way out of debt, that doesn't get talked about much.
More and more it does, though, definitely. And I think scholars in the last 15, 20 years have raised all those issues. And people coming to Monticello over the years have asked for more about this. But it's fascinating to see the different perspectives that visitors bring. They have a conception of Jefferson either as a, quote, good master, oxymoron, as our guides always said, who would have freed his slaves if he could. Some people think that. And a number of black visitors sort of see slavery at Monticello through a prism of thinking about whips and rape and things like that. And, it, you know, it's in between in every case, but the interest in it and the willingness of people to dig a little deeper and think more seriously about this issue, I think is definitely been increasing over the years.
One of the more damning accusations, and it does show up in your book where you're basically just showing what the records show against Jefferson, is for what he allowed to happen to the human beings he owned when he was not there, when basically his plantations, and he owned more than Monticello, were being run by overseers, some of whom were thought of as extremely harsh.
I'm silent because what you've just said is very true, and it's harsh to think about that. Those times when Jefferson was not paying attention. We know that when he was in Philadelphia, he wrote back to Monticello to make sure that the young boys in his nail factory were not whipped. But he was gone half the time when he was a public servant. And what happened in his absence, we can't know really all of it, but it's apparent that some of the people he left in charge were cruel. We know in the case of Sally Hemings' nephew, Jamie Hemings, who was working in the nailery, that he was whipped severely by the overseer when he was too sick to go to work, and he ran away after that. But an interesting fact about this is that Jefferson did not pursue him. He tried to encourage him to come back, saying he wouldn't have to be under that overseer or in that overseer's charge. But Jamie Hemings never returned. He got on the James River and went off into the sunset. But Jefferson made no effort to capture him.
Sabrina, thank you so very much for your call. Cinder Stanton, author of this new book, Those Who Labor for My Happiness. I really do want to get into at least some detail of the Getting Word project that you helped organize more than 20 years ago, because it led to such revelation as you talked to descendants of Jefferson slaves, including the Hemings family, descendants of Sally Hemings and descendants who absolutely believe that they also are descendants of Thomas Jefferson himself. But before we get to that, let's at least make time for Peter and Crozet's call, since he's been hanging on for a bit. Peter, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment, please.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Let me say as context that when I was growing up in Alabama, Jefferson was a real hero of mine. I mean, historically, I really admired him. And then I came up here to go to the University of Virginia. Coincidentally, I think. And at some point, I read a list of quotes from Thomas Jefferson. And one of those quotes, if I remember correctly, said more or less, the most profitable part of our operation here is a slave mother giving birth to children. And I don't think I thought a lot about that quote when I read it, but over time, I really began to see the stark contrast between that concept of profitability because you're birthing new slaves and his overall philosophy.
Yes, Peter, he said that more than once. And we have to look at those comments in the context of to whom was he writing. In the case you talk about, he was writing to an overseer at another plantation. I think in terms that overseer would understand, and it wasn't just you know, a bald statement of the children of the enslaved women is an addition to capital. It was comparing it to their labor. He said it was more valuable than their labor. And so what he was trying to do is get that overseer to treat women better on the plantation. So it's so much more complicated than just that. I mean, it makes us all cringe, obviously, to read those sentences, but we have to see them in all the details of what he was considering his statement in connection with. I'm not putting it very well, but
no, you're very helpful.
Oh, good. good.
Peter, thank you so very much for your call. I apologize if I'm cutting you short, but we've only got a few minutes left, and Cinder, I want to make sure that you tell us at least a little bit more about this oral history project and what you felt you learned from it.
Okay, well, my colleague Diane Swan-Wright and I and our consultant in Ohio, Beverly Gray, have been working on this project for 20 years, and over that time, and it was very part-time as we went along, but we've interviewed 180 people, most of them descendants of a dozen African-American families enslaved at Monticello, and traveled to California, Washington State, Boston, and many times to Ohio, because that's where a number of former slaves moved after gaining their freedom, particularly the Hemings family. And about 80 of those 180 people were descendants of Elizabeth Betty Hemings through three of her daughters, Sally, Mary, and Betty. And
Sally Hemings, of course, the person who many historians now believe did, in fact, birth several children fathered by Thomas Jefferson. And your beliefs also have changed on that.
This project had a huge influence on my beliefs on that issue. That's certainly true, because our first trip was to Chillicothe, Ohio, where Sally Hemings' sons, Madison and Eston, moved in the 1830s, and we saw the buildings that Madison Hemings had constructed. We saw the farm he lived in. We interviewed a number of his descendants who just had a matter-of-fact family history. We are descended from Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. It wasn't anything they made a big deal about. In fact, they kept it within the family quite closely, because over the years they had had to cling to this family history in a climate of hostility and denial. And so just hearing how they spoke of that and learning about Madison Hemings as a person was almost a sort of a real epiphany for me in taking another look at Madison Hemings' recollections of 1873, where he several times calls Jefferson his father. So that was the beginning of a shift in my view. Also talking to Diane and Beverly about these issues, and a couple of years later, Annette Gordon Reed as well, who had really mastered all the historical record dealing with this issue, having fascinating conversations with her. So even before DNA in 1998, my view was heading toward belief in the relationship of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings.
It seems to me from reading your book, Those Who Labor for My Happiness, where you talk about this oral history project, which is only a portion of what's in your book, I get the impression that you got great insight, pleasure, but also great sadness from the stories that you heard, including the fact that many of the people who believed that they were Jefferson's descendants were very light-skinned, some of them able to pass as white, and that ended up splitting up lots of families when some went off to live as whites and their descendants lived as whites and others stayed as African-Americans.
Right. We heard very painful stories of division in families because of the need to make a better life for one's family. And back in those Jim Crow years at the beginning of the 20th century, if someone looked white enough to pass for white, it was often the only way they could get a good job and make a good life for their families.
Cinder, I'm so sorry that we've got less than 30 seconds
left.
We
have 30 seconds? Oh, my goodness.
I've got to ask this question, though. What do you hope somebody would get from reading your book?
Well, 30 seconds worth, I hope they would get enough so that they would go out and want to get more, basically. And really, it's a fascinating topic with many avenues to explore. And I hope people go out and read everything they can.
Bottom line, life of Thomas Jefferson is not easy or simple to understand. Yes, agree, disagree?
Oh, no problem agreeing with that one.
Well, your book certainly took me to that conclusion. Thank you so much. Our guest has been the Shannon Senior Historian Emerita for the Thomas Jefferson Foundation at Monticello, Lucia Cinder Stanton. Her newest book is titled Those Who Labor for My Happiness, Slavery at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. Cinder, thank you again.
Thank you, Tom.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. If you go to that page, you will find links to more information about Ms. Stanton's work. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.